This is the tax update for December 29, 2008. This week, medical expenses testing the limits. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use includes using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Well, I'm finally getting back into the podcast recording mechanism after being on the road and doing a number of continuing education presentations over the past few weeks. It's been a wild trip on the road for a couple of reasons, one of which was I had an issue involved just shortly after Thanksgiving where the keyboard on my old laptop finally decided to give up. The Q key started repeating constantly when I turned it on. So I ended up having to take a new laptop on the road at the last instant, and the new laptop is now what I'm recording this one on. Current recording here is now with a MacBook Pro with 4 gigabytes of RAM, so this week is running on a bit of a larger and faster machine than previously was running on. And I also had a number of trips during that week, and as you may be aware, the weather got a little bit interesting here in December. And while I never got caught into weather problems, I did get caught with airline problems that issued from weather problems, where a plane I was supposed to be on got trapped in Chicago for about 4 to 5 hours before I was able to get on it. So I had an interesting run at the very end of my trip getting into Raleigh, North Carolina. At 3 in the morning, I had to speak in Greensboro, North Carolina at 8:30 the next morning, and somewhere in the interim, I had to pick up a rental car and make my drive over to Greensboro about an hour and 20 minutes from Raleigh. So it was an interesting night without much sleep, but it was kind of a run and an end to the run here for doing my presentations. I only have one more set, at least currently scheduled, and that's I'm going to go up into Helena, Montana to do a 4-day presentation for a firm there that's doing some infirm training. But other than that, I should settle down on the actual travel schedule, and hopefully that means I'll be able to get more of the audio files out more on time. But now we're sitting here toward the end of the year, and this week I want to take a look at a case that looked at the rules and the limitations and gives us a reason to take a look at how Section 213 of the Code, which deals with medical expenses, works in a number of cases. The case in question involved in vitro fertilization, but perhaps in a little different way than previous items we've seen before. The case involved the case of Magdalen versus Commissioner. This is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2008-293. In this particular case, a male physician was attempting to claim his medical expenses fees he paid for in vitro fertilization procedures for fathering 2 children using his sperm that was implanted into eggs from anonymous donors, with the resulting fertilized eggs being implanted to 2 surrogate mothers with whom he entered into a gestational carrier agreement. The taxpayer pointed to a 2003 IRS private letter ruling, PLR 2003-18017, where the IRS had ruled that a woman who was unable to conceive using her own eggs was able to deduct the expense of paying for an egg donor, ruling that such a payment was a medical expense under 213. It was not on the expense of paying for the egg donor, but other related expenses up to that point that were allowed as a deduction. Dr. Magdalen argued that he should be given the same right under the law to obtain the tax benefits for his procedure. But the IRS and the tax court did not agree, and we'll take a look at their reasonings as to why they didn't agree. General rule is that medical expenses for the code are governed by Section 213. The IRS over years have issued a number of rulings, both published revenue rulings and private letter rulings, in response to specific taxpayer requests regarding the question of what particular expenses qualify as or don't qualify as medical expenses. Generally, a deduction for personal expenses is blocked by Internal Revenue Code Section 262. That section provides that except as otherwise expressly provided in this chapter, no deduction shall be allowed for personal living or family expenses. One of the specific exceptions that Congress has created to this prohibition for personal expenses under 262 involves medical expenses as defined by Internal Revenue Code Section 213. Section 213A provides that there shall be allowed as a deduction the expenses paid during the taxable year, not compensated for by insurance or otherwise, for medical care of the taxpayers, his spouse, or a dependent, as defined in Section 152, determined without regard to subsections B1, B2, and D1B thereof, to the extent that such expenses exceed 7.5% of adjusted gross income. The general rule, therefore, is that we get to claim a deduction for medical expenses paid for ourselves, paid for our spouse, and paid for our dependents. The exception you find there has to deal with the question about a dependent who has excess income beyond the personal exemption limits. We're not going to worry about that distinction here. But generally, we're allowed to take medical expenses paid for ourselves, our spouse, our dependent, with a slightly expanded version of what the word dependent means for these purposes. The key issue, therefore, becomes what exactly is medical care, the expenses for which we're eligible to obtain a deduction, even though it's a personal style expense. The code contains a definition internally for Section 213 as to what is a medical expense. And definition found at D1 tells us the term medical care means amounts paid, A, for the diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease, or for the purpose of affecting any structure or function of the body. B deals with the fact we get transportation expenses related to that. C talks about qualified long-term care services that are defined in Section 7702BC. And D talks about insurance related to medical expenses for which we will get a deduction as well. We're mainly going to look at, for this purpose, that A section, the definition there of what the medical expenses were. We're not going to care much today about the transportation, the qualified long-term care insurance. That's a discussion to be done at some other time, but not today. So in order for something to be medical care, the general expenses, presuming it's not the transportation, the insurance issue, or the long-term care services, we're looking for the amount to be paid for the diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease, or for the purpose of affecting any structure or function of the body. The first category requires that there be a recognized disease in play. We ran into that as an issue when the IRS issued a clarifying revenue ruling, Revenue Ruling 2002-19, a number of years ago regarding weight loss programs. It's what I refer to as the Jenny Craig ruling, because that particular ruling tells us that the weight loss program itself is now considered deductible. Previously, the IRS had issued revenue rulings that suggested such weight loss programs would generally be considered non-deductible, because under the prior rulings, the view was that it was primarily done to do for general well-being. Amounts expended for general well-being that aren't tied to a specific disease won't meet the first prong here. Now remember, we have two prongs. We can meet either one of the two. But previously it was felt that it didn't affect the functioning of the part of the body, the second definition that we had involved, and it wasn't for treatment of a specific disease. Rather, it was general well-being. That's a reason why you don't get medical expense deductions generally for signing up for 24-hour fitness and paying a weekly fee or paying a monthly fee to them for your gym memberships. Not going to qualify. That's general well-being expenses. The Jenny Craig ruling held that the weight loss portion of the fee was deductible. However, the special meals that they give, so if you sign up for one of those rulings, and I call it the Jenny Craig ruling, even though it never mentions Jenny Craig, because we all know that's the best known organization that does this sort of thing. But the meals that they provide, that's not deductible because it fails the test in the idea being that you have to eat anyway. This merely replaces food that you otherwise would have purchased, and there's no specific treatment required. It fails, as we'll discuss coming up shortly, the but-for test that's required in order for the medical expense to be deductible. But the fact that now, in 2002, what had happened since the prior rulings have been issued, the medical community in general had recognized severe obesity as a disease. Once it was recognized as a disease generally in the scientific community, that gives us the hook we needed to get the treatment of that disease as a deductible medical expense. The second key cure is, even if it's not a disease, there's a second category of expenses that will qualify as medical expenses, and that is for the purpose of affecting any structure or function of the body. That second category is necessarily broader. It looks at items that affect any structure or function of the body, and there does not have to be any disease involved. However, The provision is limited by IRC Section 213(d)(9). That was enacted to remove cosmetic procedures from the list of allowed items. And it provides generally that cosmetic procedures do not, medical care does not include cosmetic surgeries or other similar procedures unless the surgery or procedure is necessary to ameliorate a deformity arising from or directly related to a congenital abnormality, a personal injury resulting from an accident or trauma, or a disfiguring disease. So what it means is if you're involved in an auto accident, you're required to have plastic surgery to repair damage to your face, let's say. Even though that's going to improve your appearance, it's not going to be a non-deductible cosmetic surgery. Similarly, if there's a congenital abnormality, even though that will improve the appearance of the person in question, the expense is still deductible. However, other types of cosmetic surgeries, not deductible. What is a cosmetic surgery? It means a procedure which is directed at improving the patient's appearance and does not meaningfully promote the proper function of the body or prevent or treat illness or disease. Now, that distinction has been made clear by prior rulings where we talked about things like radial keratotomy. The IRS has ruled that radial keratotomy, or LASIK, the later procedure, that both of those represent deductible medical. Why? Well, some people were concerned because it appeared the major reason why people do that is to avoid wearing glasses to improve their appearance in public. But the IRS notes that the actual medical procedure in question affects the functioning of a part of the body, and it significantly affects that functioning. It changes your eyes so they actually now your eyes actually focus properly so you can see things at the distance. And because of that, the mere fact that it has a side effect potentially of some people would believe improving their appearance does not by itself render it into the cosmetic procedure that disallows the deduction. The cosmetic procedures, as noted, have to be procedures that, in the view of the code at least, only have the ability of improving appearances, but does not meaningfully change the function of any part of the body or treat any disease. Being nearsighted, or being farsighted, I should say, is actually, or nearsighted, is a disease per se. It's a misfunctioning of the body. For that reason, no problem taking your LASIK. Now, this cosmetic surgery provision was enacted in 1990 in response to reality that the IRS and the courts had rather broadly interpreted that functioning of the body provision and allowed a whole range of procedures, including facelifts, to be qualified as medical deductions. But it should be noted that because Congress took this kind of laser approach to come in and get exactly the cosmetic items out of there, items that aren't cosmetic will still qualify as deduction if they affect the functioning of a part of the body or if they treat the disease. The tax court notes in the case we're looking at today that it applies a but-for test generally to expenses that are medical. And the test it outlined it notes in the case of Jacobs versus Commissioner, 62 TC 813. Under that test, any expense incurred must be both an essential element of the treatment and an expense that would not otherwise have been incurred for non-medical reasons. In the Jenny Craig ruling, the food is going to be incurred whether or not you're being treated under Jenny Craig. You're still going to have your meals every day. You're still going to eat food. You have to eat food. That's going to be incurred in any event. For that reason, the food portion of the payments to Jenny Craig, non-deductible, personal expenses. The weight treatment, the weight loss treatment portion of the program, deductible medical expense. Now, the particular issue we're going to deal with today, which deals with reproductive issues and special procedures taken for people that have reproductive problems, the IRS in 2003 issued a letter ruling that dealt with the issues dealing with expenses related to egg donation. This time in the context of a woman who was looking to pay a fee to an egg donor to obtain eggs that would be fertilized, then implanted in her. The taxpayer in question had been treated for fertility issues for a period of time, and it appears the decision was made that an egg donor with later in vitro fertilization gave the best chances for her of conception. The facts of the situation were explained as follows in that private letter ruling 2003-18017. The IRS noted you have unsuccessfully undergone repeated assisted reproductive technology procedures to enable you to conceive a child using your own eggs. You desire to attempt pregnancy using donated eggs. Your health plan will pay expenses to fertilize and transfer an egg or embryo to you, but will not cover expenses to obtain an egg donor. you request a ruling that the following expenses are medical expenses for purposes of Section 213. The donor's fee for her time and expense in following proper procedures to ensure a successful egg retrieval. The agency fee for procuring the donor and coordinating the transaction between the donor and recipient. Expenses for medical and psychological testing of the donor prior to the procedure, and insurance for any medical or psychological assistance the donor may require after the procedure, and legal fees for preparing a contract between you and the egg donor. The IRS notes in the ruling that they had previously ruled in Revenue Ruling 73201 and 73603 that vasectomies and procedures to render a woman incapable of having children qualified as medical expenses. The IRS noted that, similarly, procedures to facilitate a pregnancy would seem to affect the structure or function of the body for the person who is going to become pregnant. And for that reason, it would still be medical expenses. But this issue is a little different because we're looking at now not the expenses that were going for her, because the insurance company was perfectly willing to pay for her expenses. What they were not willing to pay for was the expenses of the egg donor. So the IRS continued its analysis and said, expenses preparatory to the performance of a procedure that qualifies as medical care that are directly related to the procedure may also constitute medical care for purposes of Section 213. For example, Revenue Ruling 68452 holds that surgical, hospital, and transportation expenses incurred by a donor in connecting with donating a kidney to the taxpayer are deductible medical expenses of a taxpayer recipient for the years in which the taxpayer pays them, subject to the limits of Section 213. Similarly, expenses the taxpayer pays to obtain an egg donor, including the donor's expenses, are directly related and preparatory to the taxpayer's receiving the donated egg or embryo. The expenses are therefore the taxpayer's medical expenses and are deductible by the taxpayer in the year paid. Like other preparatory expenses, legal expenses may be deductible as medical expenses under Section 213 if there is a direct or proximate relationship between the legal expenses and the provision of medical care to the taxpayer. They note Lynn v. Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision, 1998-85. For example, legal expenses incurred to create a guardianship in order to involuntarily hospitalize a mentally ill taxpayer were held to be deductible medical expenses because the medical treatment could not otherwise have occurred. That was a case of Gerstacker v. Commissioner, 414 F. 2nd, 448 from the Sixth Circuit in 1969. In contrast, the court in Jacobs v. Commissioner, 62 T.C. 813, held that legal expenses related to obtaining a divorce as a taxpayer claim was necessary for his mental health were not deductible because the divorce would have occurred regardless of the taxpayer's depression. Thus, the legal expenses were not directly related to the taxpayer's medical treatment. The IRS goes on to say you have represented that you will pay the fee to the donor, the fee to the agency that procured the donor, the donor's medical and psychological testing expenses, the insurance for post-procedure medical or psychological assistance to the donor, and the cost of legal contract between you and the donor in order to enable you to obtain a donated egg for implantation into your body. Because these costs are preparatory to the performance of your own medical procedure, the expenses are medical care for purposes of Section 213. Thus, the IRS held that all of the following were allowable as medical deductions for this individual: the fee paid to the doctor, the fee paid to the agency that procured the donor, the donor's medical and psychological testing expenses, insurance for post-procedure medical or psychological assistance to the donor, and legal costs related to the contract with the donor. However, it's important to note that the ruling indicated these expenses were specifically allowed because they were preparatory to the performance of the taxpayer's own medical procedure. As note below, that became a crucial issue in the case at hand. In today's case, we're looking at a slightly different set of facts than outlined in that ruling. First and most obvious, the individual in this case is male. So unlike the PLR above, in this case, the donor eggs are obviously not going to be implanted into the taxpayer. Rather, in this case, the donor eggs are going to end up being implanted into a surrogate mother who will be compensated to basically go through the pregnancy. And basically, that's going to be the case involved. So Mr. Magdalene, obviously, is not going to be the person that's going to have the eggs come back. Now, Mr. Magdalene argued that this should not make a difference in result compared to the private letter ruling. After all, in his view, it is unfair to deny him the benefits of the deduction simply because he was a man. The court summarized his arguments this way. Petitioner argues that it was his civil right to reproduce, and that he should have the same freedom, the freedom to choose a method of reproduction, and that it is sex discrimination to allow women but not men to choose how they will reproduce. Mr. Magdalene had entered into the following agreements that were at issue in this case. The court notes, in July 2004, petitioner entered into an anonymous egg donor agreement under which an anonymous donor was to donate eggs to be fertilized with petitioner's sperm and transfer it to a gestational carrier using the IVF process, in vitro fertilization. That same month, petitioner also entered into a gestational carrier agreement in which a woman, the first carrier, agreed to become impregnated through the IVF embryo transfer process with the embryo created from the anonymous donor's egg and petitioner's sperm, and to bear a child for petitioner. The first carrier gave birth to a child on September 17, 2005. On November 18, 2005, petitioner entered into a similar gestational carrier agreement with another woman, the second carrier. The second carrier gave birth to a child on August 12, 2006. The donor was not the spouse or dependent of the petitioner, nor was either of the carriers. Both IVF procedures occurred at Reproduction Science Center, IVF Clinic, in Lexington, Massachusetts. Dr. Magdalene incurred a number of expenses related to these procedures. Those were summarized by the court as follows. Dr. Magdalene paid the following expenses in 2004 related to the aforementioned agreement. $3,500 for the petitioner's legal fees regarding the first donation cycle under the anonymous egg donor agreement. $500 for the donor's legal fees related to the anonymous egg donor agreement. $10,750 for the donor's fees and expenses. $8,000 for the first carrier's fees and expenses. $25,400 to the in vitro fertilization clinic, and $2,815 for prescription drugs for the first carrier. In 2005, he paid the following relevant expenses: $750 for legal fees related to the second donation cycle under the anonymous egg donor agreement, $17,000 for the first carrier's fees and expenses, $14,270 for the petitioner's legal fees related to the gestational carrier agreement with the second carrier, $1,000 for the second carrier's legal fees related to the gestational carrier agreement, $2,615.10 to the in vitro fertilization clinic, $300 to Lawrence General Hospital for costs related to the first carrier's stay during delivery of the first child, $1,181.25 for the first carrier's legal fees relating to legal proceedings concerning a dispute over issuance of the first child's birth certificate, and $838 for prescription drugs for both carriers. There is no evidence that petitioner was compensated for any of these expenses by insurance or otherwise. Dr. Magdalene claimed that the expenses on his personal income tax returns for the years in question. The IRS examined his return, disallowed these expenses, and eventually, obviously, we end up with a tax in the tax court to resolve the question of whether Dr. Magdalene got a deduction for expenses in 2004 and 2005 related to these items. The key question is whether or not these expenses constitute payment for medical care or not. As noted earlier, there are two tests for qualifying a payment for medical care. In this case, there was no issue regarding the treatment of a disease. The tax court noted at the beginning of the case that at all relevant times, Dr. Magdalene's sperm count and motility were found to be within normal limits. He has twin sons from a marriage to his former spouse, Deborah Magdalene. The twins were born through natural processes and without the use of in vitro fertilization. The court notes essentially, you know, reading between the lines, that Dr. Magdalene was perfectly capable, you know, had no restrictions in going through a, quote, normal, shall we say, unquote, process for delivery of reproducing children. There was no limitation on his ability to reproduce, and as we'll discover, since his sperm was used in this case and fertilized the eggs in question, everything, you know, his end, nothing unusual took place. His problem was he had no way of delivering, being, you know, a male. There was no way to deliver the child without using some other mechanism. That was the fertilization process with the use of a surrogate mother. The tax court noted the expenses at issue were not paid for the medical care under the first portion of Section 213 D1A because the requisite causal relationship is absent. None of the expenses were incurred primarily for the prevention or alleviation of a physical or mental defect or illness. That's Regulation Section 1.213-1E1II. In other words, petitioner had no medical condition or defect, such as, example, infertility, that required treatment or mitigation through in vitro fertilization procedures. We therefore need not answer lurking questions as to whether and if so to what extent. Expenditures for in vitro fertilization procedures and associated costs, such as taxpayers' legal fees or fees paid to and on behalf of a surrogate or gestational carrier, would be deductible in the presence of an underlying medical condition. There was no medical condition with Dr. Magdalene. Now the question was, what about the second part of this test? That part involves affecting the function of a structure or function of the body. The IRS stated its position as summarized by the court as follows. Although IRS believes that the amounts paid for procedures to mitigate infertility may qualify as deductible medical care, the IRS argued that Dr. Magdalene had no physical or mental defect or illness which prohibited him from procreating naturally, as he in fact has, and that the procedures were not medically indicated. The IRS's position is that the expenses at issue were non-deductible under Section 262 because petitioner's choice to undertake these procedures was an entirely personal non-medical decision. In a footnote reference, the court specifically discusses the IRS's position regarding the effects of structure or function clause by noting, the IRS also argued that the expenses paid by a petition were not for purposes affecting any structure or function of petitioner's male body, and that the procedures at issues only affected the structures or functions of the bodies of the unrelated surrogate mothers. In the IRS view, to the extent these were medical expenses, they were medical expenses of the mothers, parties for whom the taxpayer did not have a right to claim medical expense deductions on his return. The tax court agreed with the IRS's view and dismissed the taxpayer's attempt to argue constitutional matters to justify the deduction. The court noted, although petitioner at times attempts to frame the deductibility of the relevant expenses as an issue of constitutional dimensions, under the facts and circumstances of his case, it does not rise to that level. Petitioner's gender, marital status, and sexual orientation do not bear on whether he can deduct the expenses at issue. He cannot deduct those expenses because he has no medical condition or defect to which expenses relate, and because they did not affect the structure or function of his body. Expenses incurred in the absence of requisite underlying medical condition or defect that do not affect the structure or function of the taxpayer's body are non-deductible personal expenses within the meaning of Section 262. In the court's view, Section 262 blocks a deduction unless the taxpayer meets the narrow exception carved out by Section 213. And the fact the expense in question did not treat a disease of nor affect the functioning of the body of Dr. Magdalene or one of the limited sets of individuals for which a code allowed him to claim a deduction was fatal to the deduction. In conclusion, it's important to note that the fact that the treatment did not impact Dr. Magdalene was crucial in this case. The lack of an effect on his body was the ultimate deciding force in this decision. Remember, under the in vitro fertilization letter ruling, the fact was that everything was preparatory to an impact on the mother's body, and we're looking at the mother's ability to claim a tax deduction. The court also specifically refused to rule on the question of whether the situation would have turned out differently if Dr. Magdalene had been infertile, or if the taxpayer had been female, but for medical reasons it was determined that a surrogate mother was needed to carry the child. The court specifically dodged that question and noted it was dodging that question. There was no need to answer it, and it wouldn't answer it at this point. The IRS letter ruling noted above specifically indicated the payments for issues related to the donor were deductible because they were in preparation for a medical procedure on the taxpayer. If you take that literally, it would suggest if we used a surrogate mother instead of the taxpayer, because perhaps the taxpayer in question would be unable to carry the child to term, that it would appear under that argument, based on that letter ruling, that the IRS might question whether there was a medical deduction in play. The IRS, in fact, doesn't argue that. Obviously, they didn't have to rule that in that ruling, and that's not where they rule. And the court clearly didn't want to go there here in this case. Similarly, the IRS publication relating to payments for in vitro fertilization seems to indicate that you must show that the payments are required, essentially have to be required, in order for someone to treat a fertility problem. If perhaps a group or this, you know, we had a a woman who received in vitro fertilization, perhaps from an anonymous sperm donor. Question is, would that be deductible medical expenses? The IRS publications suggest, well, maybe not. I think there's a lot tougher time for the IRS to argue that one, though, because it would appear to be difficult from reading the code to not say that didn't affect the functioning of a portion of the body. And I doubt it's going to fail the but-for test. It seems like the medical condition, you know, the medical issue caused it to happen. But we'd have to see. The IRS publications certainly suggest the IRS might try to take the position that, in fact, there was no medical necessity for that structure. As I said, I think that's a lot tougher argument, but nevertheless one that their publications suggest they might try to take. The other key thing to remember as we finish this, where real impact comes here, comes most often for taxpayers where it's actually useful, because remember, we have the 7.5% of AGI limitation. The real issue becomes, can people take money from flexible spending accounts, or could we take funds from a health savings account and use them for these purposes? And again, these sections refer back to the definition under 213. We would again need to look to the issue of 213 and its rulings. Realize that especially in the case of an employer plan with a flexible savings account, the administrator of the plans quite often are fairly conservative and are not necessarily want to go out on a limb without getting some sort of ruling from the IRS that states that the payment in question is deductible. So if a taxpayer in fact had to use a surrogate mother for the purposes because of issues where the woman in question who's a taxpayer would be unable to carry the child to term, then there may be a lot more interesting issue getting the payment out of the carrier or getting the payment out of the flexible spending account without going for a private letter ruling to specifically address the question of whether that particular transaction would be a medical expense. This has been the tax update for this week. It was kind of an interesting one to look at from the rule and gave us a chance to review Section 213. The tax update, as always, is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Be sure to go there, take a look at their newsletters, look at some of the issues that are involved. Recently, we've had discussions dealing with issues like the waiver of the required minimum distribution and some of the other interesting factors that were packed into the pension bill we recently saw. So consider going there, taking a look at their services, consider subscribing to them. This has been the Tax Update.